are guaranteed our civil rights by the Constitution, and the system failed.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. During World War II, almost 120,000 Japanese Americans were forced into internment camps. More than 10,000 were located right here in Wyoming. On this episode, we'll hear firsthand accounts about that time period. A new book compiles government photos of Japanese Americans in these camps, including Heart Mountain Relocation Center in Wyoming. For the first time, some of the people in the photos have been interviewed. Those interviews are included in Un-American, the Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. As co-author Richard Kahan tells Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones, camp conditions were poor.
People were taken and put into horse stalls temporarily. They were put into things that were like army barracks. They were hastily constructed and the wind blew in through holes. There were these little, quote, apartments, which sometimes were for 10 or 15 people, had one light bulb. The bathrooms had very little privacy. The camps were generally surrounded by barbed wires with, as you'll see in the book, soldiers with guns, and they were literally put in deserts. The Heart Mountain camp was a very hostile place, not a place that people wanted to live. The photos in the book allude to the problems, but I think it's the personal narratives from people that really talk about how they felt.
Why did the government want to photograph the camps at all?
It was common among government agencies in the 1930s and early 1940s to photograph their work, to promote their work to Congress and to the American public. And I think there was also a feeling of the government wanted to show that Japanese Americans were treated in what the government perceived as a humane manner. The other reason is when the government takes over the photo documentation of something, then they can keep others out.
There were a lot of photos in this book that just really were powerful, but one that I found maybe the most compelling was of Toshi Mizoguchi. And he's the old man with the American flag button who wasn't allowed to become a citizen. Was there a photo or maybe a couple photos that really jumped out at you that were just really powerful or compelling?
My favorite is of a little 11-year-old girl. Her name was Rachel Kuruma, and she's posing in front of a blank wall, and she's got this beautiful little Japanese top that she's wearing. And it was taken by Dorothea Lange. She was a great documentarian of the 20th century. Dorothea Lange had this remarkable ability to get close to people and to take pictures that could look into people's eyes and help us empathize with the situation. And I had a chance to figure out who Rachel Kuruma was. She was identified on the caption as a woman by the name of Rachel Kurumi, and there were no Rachel Kurumis when we looked through the records. And we just kept on typing the names, and one came up. We had a sense that this was the right person because she was born in the 1930s in San Francisco, and we did find that she was alive and living in San Francisco today. She's 85. In fact, I talked to her earlier today again to say hello to her. She had no memory of the picture, no idea that it was taken. And when I did get to talk to her last summer and show her the picture, I came up to her house and I asked her if this was her. And she looked at it very carefully and she smiled. She's 85 years old, and here's this 11-year-old beautiful little girl. And she's a beautiful woman now. And she looked at it and she said, "I was quite presentable then."
Another photographer whose story I found really compelling was Carl
Iwasaki.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about his story?
He was a internee, somebody who was, one of the Japanese Americans who were taken and put into the internment camp. There were 10 of them. He was put in the internment camp in Heart Mountain, Wyoming. He was hired in around 1944 to work in the darkroom of the Government Photography Bureau, and he must have done such a good job, they gave him a camera, and he was only about 20, 22 years old, and they said, "You can go out," and they wanted him to photograph the relocation efforts. During the war and after the war, people were allowed to leave camp and relocate in the Midwest and the East and after the war in California. And I agree with you. I think his pictures are incredibly... They don't look like promotional pictures. They are very intimate, and he ended up having a long career working for Sports Illustrated and for Life magazine.
What is it about photography versus, say, written history that compels you?
Well, I've had a chance over the last year to look at the written documentation of the incarceration. There's some great books, but there's something about photography, I think, that in our minds provide evidence, and in our minds take us back to the scene. When we look out over the desert plain at a concentration camp, it's at a photo of that, it's almost as if we are there.
Throughout the book, you have profiles of people who are in the photos who are still living. Was it difficult to track down those people?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I've been a journalist all my life, and this was really the largest challenge I've ever had. First off, many of the people who were photographed were not identified by the photographers who took their pictures. So what helped us is many of the people had tags on them, and the tags had their family numbers, and those numbers are now available. You can find those online. We connected those numbers to the family. Once we had the family, we still didn't know who the person was, and it was a matter of looking through family records, oftentimes Ancestry.com, the kind of things that many people use, and oftentimes that would lead to an obituary from somebody in the family, and we'd find out who the surviving family members were, and they would oftentimes lead us to the subjects of the pictures. We were surprised to find that most of the subjects that we were looking for were alive. We kind of made a list of 30 people that we wanted to find, and we ended up finding 25 of them. You know, this happened 75 years ago, so everybody who was pictured was pretty much 75 years or older, and we did talk to people who were kids when this happened, and we talked to people who are now 95. They were 20 and 25 years old. When we did finally get to people, they almost universally were happy to be contacted and happy to share their stories with us.
In the book, there are mentioned a lot of people who were working for the government at the time or were somehow involved with making the decision to start the incarceration camps, who later changed their mind and thought, oh, never mind, the incarceration camps were a bad idea. We shouldn't have done that. Did you ever come across anyone who didn't change their mind, who continued to think that it was a good idea?
There are people who thought at the time that this was the right decision. I think most thinking people had major reservations. Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's wife, later said that it's easy to make a mistake and very hard to turn around a mistake. Most of the people who were leaders at the time, like Earl Warren and Tom Clark, both of whom ended up as Supreme Court justices, later very much regretted the decision. But there were people in the Army who, to the day they died, thought that what happened was correct.
Even decades later, they did?
I think they did, yeah. You know, I think we have to go back to the start of America's involvement in World War II. There were over 2,000 Americans killed in Pearl Harbor, and within days of Pearl Harbor, there were already blackout drills in San Francisco. And the West, people who lived along the West Coast were really terrified of what might happen. So there was a sense that the 110,000 Japanese Americans that lived along the West Coast, there was worry that there would be sabotage, that there would be espionage, that there would be other types of spying. The problem was there was absolutely no evidence of it. The president left the decision of what to do with Japanese Americans up to the U.S. Army. On the surface, that would seem to make sense because the Army was in charge of, you know, the security of the United States. But the problem was that the Army did not consider or care about the civil liberties of actual American citizens. And about 70,000 of these 110,000 people were U.S. citizens. And so they suggest that they be taken and put in camps. And I think what this book shows more than anything else is what happens when fear eclipses civil liberties. One question that I kept asking as I did this book was, how would I respond? How would I have responded if I was living through those years? And I think that, Aaron, did you ask that question to yourself when you were looking at these pictures?
I did. I did think about that.
And it's a hard one. I mean, obviously, we don't know. Just like we don't know the future, we don't know what we would have done in the past. But I think that's the key to this book. I think my hope is, at least, is that readers will ask that question themselves. I don't think we're going to ever have internment incarceration camps like this in the future. I certainly hope not. But there are similar issues that we're facing. You know, the idea of a Muslim registry and the idea of separating America because of their religious or their ethnic classification is something that certainly hasn't gone away, and worries of what we do when we're worried, when we face security concerns, is something that's certainly alive today. So I think the book has more relevance than I expected when I wrote it.
That's author Richard Kahan speaking with Aaron Jones. His new book is Un-American: The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. The Heart Mountain Relocation Center near Cody was one of 10 internment camps across the U.S. Sam Mihara is a survivor of that camp. He sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard to talk about how, after staying away from Wyoming for more than 40 years, he was able to come back.
The government let us out for visits to Cody and Powell, but a few families at a time. They said, you know, for this one day, you can go and do your shopping. And I remember going into Cody and walking down Sheridan Avenue with my parents, and almost every store, many stores, not everyone, but many stores had these signs, no Japs, J-A-P-S, were allowed. And that's been an indelible mark in my memory. I'll never forget that. And that was my first exposure to on a personal basis of a serious racial discrimination. And my reaction was, well, I don't want to come back anyway. And so I stayed away from Wyoming for some 40 years, and I think that was a mistake.
What made you come back?
The reason I came back is I had heard there was an activity at Heart Mountain to try to restore the site. It was a very, very important part of American history. And so I was curious. I wondered, gee, what are they going to do to try to restore the site? And so there was an opportunity to come through northern Wyoming, and I rented a car and went out to the camp. I was greeted by one of the ladies, a local Powell lady named LaDonna Zoll, who met me at the campsite on that Road 19 going into the camp, and wearing a big smile. And I'll never forget that. And my first reaction was, gosh, a Wyoming person who smiles. I've never seen that before. And so she introduced herself as LaDonna Zoll, and she's been working tirelessly on a campaign to try to restore the camp. And she greets people, and she's developed a skill for retaining the artifacts from the camp and try to develop the museum with the real items that were used in the camp. So my perspective of the people of Wyoming changed through LaDonna, and ever since, that was about maybe 5-6 years ago, I've been back frequently. I come back maybe about every other month now and try to talk to people and meet more people.
How did it feel to be in that place again?
Well, lots of memories. They just brought in a barrack they found in Shell, Wyoming, about 80 miles from the campsite, and it was near perfect. And so when I walked into that barrack for the first time, immediate reaction was, gosh, I lived in one of these, in a room 20 feet by 20 feet, the whole family. And there's nothing like the feeling of seeing and being inside of a facility that you were kept as a prisoner.
Have you been able to forgive, to come to peace with what happened?
Yeah, the issue having to do with am I comfortable with what's happened and the aftermath of all of that? And I don't think I will ever be, you know, 100% satisfied. We did receive an apology from the government, a letter signed by the first President George Bush, the bill that was signed by President Ronald Reagan, all stating clearly that an apology is made. That all helps. You know, in my lifetime, that's probably all I should expect as far as what happened during the camp.
How do you think this experience affected you as an adult?
Probably the most important that I realized that here's an experience that there were some lessons learned, very, very important lessons learned. All of us who were American citizens had our fundamental civil rights taken away from us when the government removes us from our homes without justice, without due process, without going to a court and determining whether or not we were guilty. And that principle I learned is very important. And so what I like to do is to pass on that word to many, many other people, as many people as I can get to. And I've reached over 25,000 people in the last several years with a message on here's what happened during those years, 42 to 45. And the lesson learned is that it should not happen to anyone.
Today, the Heart Mountain Foundation hosts a pilgrimage to preserve and memorialize the history of incarceration during the war. So let's hear from two more former internees interviewed during the pilgrimage.
My name is Shigeru Yabu. I was born in San Francisco, California. Nobody told us we were going to Wyoming. We got on the train, and finally, late one evening, we landed up in Heart Mountain. The very next day, my friend, Akira Yoshimura, comes over, and let's go exploring. So nearby, there was a lot of little sand dunes, and we saw a little hole. And so we got one of the sage brushes, and it got a branch, and poked it. And out came a bug about this big. And he said, hey, you know, that'll make a good pet. Not having any brothers, having pet was very important. Well, later on, we found out it was a scorpion. So we put it back in, you know, towards the hole and says goodbye. One time, there was our next door neighbor, a fellow by the name of Ken Sewell. He was known as the expert marksmanship with slingshots. So one of the kids said, there's a magpie nest way up high. Let's see if we could hit it. And next thing you know, you could see the nest wobbling. It hit the ground, it rolled. Little did we know that there was a magpie baby bird in there. One of the little older boys said, do you know, that bird's gonna die. I said, how do you know? Because the mother bird cannot lift the magpie baby bird up to another nest. I says, that bird's going to live. It's going to be my bird, like a brother. I still don't know whether it was a male or female, but I called it Maggie. So became great friends. When I went to school, I would say, hello, Maggie. When I came home, I say, hello, Maggie. When I went to play with my friends, I would say, instead of saying goodbye, I say, hello, Maggie. One day, as I was just about ready to go up the stair, I said, hello, Maggie. And I heard, hello, Maggie. And I looked, thinking somebody's playing a trick with me. And nobody's around. So I went in front of the cage. I looked at that bird, eye to eye, and I said, hello, Maggie. And that bird said, hello, Maggie. Well, next thing you know, it picked up other words. Come on, Maggie. And my mother used to say, what you doing? And the bird would say, what you doing? It learned to whistle. And that bird could laugh and mimic you exactly the way you laugh. It was August the 14th, 1945. The sirens went off for the first time. We were playing basketball outside. And we knew the war ended. And Maggie and I would talk about, someday we're going to go to San Francisco. And probably you won't be able to live with us, but I'm going to donate you to the San Francisco Zoo. Then I could come and visit you each weekend. And middle of October, Maggie was on the bottom of the cage, eyes flickering. So Maggie slept under my bed. I got up early in the morning, and she was hard as a rock. I dug a hole. Her favorite toys went in burial. Gave my T-shirt to Maggie. Buried it. Made a cross. I was the only one there. And it was a sad moment. Maggie did not want to leave Wyoming nor Heart Mountain.
I'm Takashi Hoshizaki, and from Los Angeles. I was 16 years old when all of this happened. We finally ended up in Heart Mountain. Well, a typical day for me was basically working in the mess hall. I had the afternoons free, so then that was the time that I took classes to finish my high school degree. But eventually I got my draft notice, and I didn't report it. I said, no, I'm not going. Maybe a week or so later, I don't know who, the marshal, the FBI, so on, came and picked me up and began questioning me. And so I responded truthfully. And so then after that, I was just hauled around to Cody County Jail. And eventually, I ended up in Casper, Wyoming, in their jail. Later on, I find out that here there were 63 of us. We had filled up most of the county jails in the state of Wyoming. And the trial started in Cheyenne. They took us all down there, and so that we were jammed into the Cheyenne. I think that was a federal court, federal jail. Some of us ended up sleeping on the floor, and it was kind of a nightmare there. We were sentenced to 3 years, went to McNeil Island, which is in the Puget Sound. As a general rule, after you serve one-third of your sentence, then you get a parole hearing. And we did not get that parole hearing. And the reason we found out that the WRA director had written a letter to the prison authorities to keep us in as long as they could because they were afraid that the recruitment for the Army would be disrupted. We served just 2 years. We got out. And then a year or so later, Harry Truman was in office. And then he gave us a Christmas pardon to all the draft resistors. And so we ended up with nothing on our records on that. I then went to the local college, that was the Los Angeles City College, 2 years there, and then went to UCLA, got my bachelor's degree in science, and then while I was working for my master's degree, I get my second draft notice. So here I am, you know, we're all out, as we were saying, that release us, and then we would go into the Army. Well, family was out. I was now released. I had my full citizenship rights and so forth. So I was able to finish my master's. Then I was drafted and then went into the Army. So I think I served double duty. So Heart Mountain was really the only camp that had an organized resistance. And I think as time goes on, Heart Mountain will be known just for the resistance. And so it's going to be interesting 25 years from now what the exhibits and what the people will be saying.
That was Shigeru Yabu and Takashi Hoshizaki speaking. Willow Belden produced that piece. The internment of Japanese Americans affected people outside the relocation centers, too. University of Wyoming professor of history Phil Roberts tells the story of how Thomas Boylan, the late owner and operator of the fossil cabin outside of Medicine Bow, protected the identity of local Japanese Americans from relocation officers during the war.
At the very beginning of World War II, there were several young Japanese Americans working on the Union Pacific at Como Station, just down the hill and close to the railroad tracks where the fossil cabin is located. And the young men ran the risk of being sent off to a place like Heart Mountain for relocation purposes. But the story goes that the Boylans hired several of these young men after they had been fired by the railroad, because again, the railroad wasn't supposed to hire anybody of Japanese American origin for fear of sabotage, which was, of course, ridiculous. But they hired these young men to work at their gas station. And years and years later, I've talked to local people who remember those young men, and they say, oh, yes, they were Samoans. The Boylans would always say, oh, I have these young men from Samoa that are working at the gas station. And of course, if you look up their names in the census, they're distinctly not Samoan names. They're definitely names of Japanese origin, but they were able to, in essence, provide some employment and some protection for these young men during the hysterical time of World War II when everyone of Japanese American ancestry was suspect. I mean, what would be a better way to describe them as Samoans, because obviously it's American Samoa, and how many people in that part of Wyoming has ever seen anybody from Samoa, and what are the chances of anybody from Samoa during World War II to drive through on the Lincoln Highway and stop at the fossil cabin and be introduced to those guys as Samoans? There's just no chance. So it was a pretty smooth way to conceal their ethnicity. And I think a pretty interesting example of how in lots of parts of Wyoming, the whole strategy behind the relocation centers was not universally acceptable on the part of a lot of people in Wyoming. And of course, after the war, a couple of those young men came to Laramie and enrolled at UW. And I haven't checked this out yet, but I've been told that one of them returned to California to medical school and became a well-known physician in Northern California until his death just a few years ago.
LaDonna Zoll is the acting curator for the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. Her family moved to Powell near the camp when she was 10, which coincided with the internment of Japanese Americans. Zoll and her parents didn't know much about what was going on at the camp, but she vividly remembers internees leaving after the war ended.
When we arrived in Powell, the camp was there, but I didn't know what it was, and no one could answer my questions. So eventually my father picked up a military policeman who was hitchhiking, and a fella said, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but the last train leaves the camp tomorrow. So we went out. Dad took us out of school and went out on a very cold November day with the snow going horizontally as it does in Wyoming, and watched, and the people came down over the hill by threes, and they looked so miserably cold. And on either side of them, periodically, was a guard with his long woolen overcoat, his rifle, and a bayonet on the end. And they got on the train and left. And I couldn't figure it out because the war had been over for 2 months. There was a time when, of course, all the young men had gone into service, and so they took the Japanese into the fields. to top beets and that sort of thing. And that was great. The farmers really appreciated that. But the town fathers decided that they should be against the Japanese coming to town. And so there was a petition that was signed by many, many people in town opposing the people coming to town. And the assistant director at the camp went to the Powell and Cody Chambers of Commerce, but said, okay, we will not let people come to town, but we'll not let them work in the fields either. And that was a very quick change of mind because they did need the labor. It was sort of interesting because I had seen the signs, no Japs. And a lady from Sunlight Basin came to Cody and saw the signs and was absolutely horrified. She went to the Cody Club and told them that within 5 days, if those signs were not down, she was going to go to the camp, the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, and sign up an internee for every county office. And 5 days later, she came back, and all the signs were gone but one. We did have some escapees. 14 were arrested by the MPs. They were 12 to 14 years old and sneaked out under the fence and were sledding on cardboard down the foothills. But they caught them. There was nowhere for them to go. There was a great deal of malnutrition initially, so they decided they needed to do some agriculture. And one of the fellas went back to California, was permitted to go back. He had a seed company, and he brought the seeds back to plant. And the crops were beautiful. And with the camp being built, that probably brought this area out of the Depression by hiring 2,400 men and women to work and raise the camp. They have been a great attribute to this area. I joined the foundation about 14 years ago. I managed to decide that I was going to be a curator, began collecting things, and I had everything in a vault and a little shed, and it kept expanding and expanding until I took the better part of a large warehouse in Powell, and finally it's at the Interpretive Learning Center now. We're just hoping that as time passes, more and more people will come to see what happened here so that it can never happen again.
That piece was produced by Willow Belden. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. In the meantime, you can find more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Caitlin Tan and Casey McNinch produced the show. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.